Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. You're most kind. Thank you, George, for that fine introduction, and thank all of you for the welcome. It is great to be here. I'm sorry, I misunderstood the topic. I thought it was to be conservatism now and then. And so I was going to give a talk about Orrin Hatch. Or then John told me, yeah, I had it wrong. So I'm deeply honored to be here. As my vita suggests, I'm a journalist and not a scholar and not an academic. And as a journalist, I wanted to share a couple of items out of the news. Some of you may be ahead of me on this. Today, it's an incredible coincidence, today is National Hairball Awareness Day, so declared, and John thought it was next week, but it's today, and so declared, and I'm sure some of the cat fanciers here are way ahead of me on this, but that's true, it is. This is Hairball Awareness Day, and which leads naturally to the topic of Fidel Castro, and certainly one of the great constants in my adult life has been Fidel Castro, and he was around when I was coming up, and he's still around, and the other constant is American presidents and administrations knuckling under to Fidel Castro, and that certainly continues to this day, and the other is the treatment of Fidel Castro by the media, and I brought with me a clipping from the Washington Post. This is one of many such that could be cited, but this was the story from last Thursday's Post. It was right after the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals had issued the order basically saying that that Elion should not be turned over to the his father right away and or to the Cubans right away. And so there was a reporter of the Washington Post in Cardenas, Cuba, which is the hometown of Elion, a fellow named John Ward Anderson. And he wrote this story about the outrage of the citizens of this town about this interference of our courts with President Clinton's action. And they did not understand this. How could a court so asked these randomly selected Cuban citizens, how could a court interfere with the order of the president? And so this Washington Post reporter writes this, Cubans in general, who are accustomed to swift and forceful justice under Castro, I thought, rewrite that sentence. Germans in general, one could say a lot more about that, but I won't. The other thing that struck me, I am a Methodist. I don't know how many of you knew that. I don't brag about it. But my church, the Methodist Church, or some spinoff thereof, is involved with this. It's either Craig Gregg or Greg Craig. I can't get it straight. And the National Council of Churches, they're all kind of intertwined with this guy, and he's representing the father, and he's representing Clinton, and he's representing Castro, I guess. And so some conservatives say the National Council of Churches is involved in this, and isn't that mixing religion and politics? And I say, well, you know, that's really not fair because the National Council of Churches has nothing to do with religion. So, uh, very consistent about that. And in any event, that's news items of the day. The Ilion story goes on. That is not my assignment. I will now go ahead and try to perform my assignment. I don't think I have any great words of wisdom to impart on this. I'm sure I don't. But I can kind of recap the history of it as I saw it and to some degree took part in it. And this is kind of necessary. Many people here know quite as much about this as I do and did also take part in it. But the public at large perhaps doesn't know this, and so we should all try to get it down and get it communicated. And the problem we have in the historical profession today is we have two kinds of history, basically. There's liberal history, and then there's no history. And the liberal history is tendentious, to put it mildly, and the spiritual father of this was Rousseau, who in his discourse on inequality says very early, let us begin by putting aside all the facts, for they do not affect the question. Well, that's kind of the way the liberal history books are written. The facts are secondary to the thesis and to the predetermined conclusion, and then you kind of hustle up stuff to support that. And then the no history, which is perhaps is equally prevalent, is just the fact that people don't know any history at all. The classic case of this was reported to me by Pat Corton, who is, I think, known to many in this room. He's a member of our board at the National Journalism Center. He told me a story, a true story, that he was watching in some city, somewhere in the country, back in 1994, which was the 50th anniversary of D-Day, programming about the Normandy invasion and so on. And he was watching this young lady, could have been a guy now, just happened to be a young lady, reading the teleprompter about these events, and in so reading, she referred to World War XI. And so you got this kind of mix of the liberal history, and then you got the World War XI type history. And so the history that we get about the conservative movement and about Ronald Reagan and so on is kind of a mix of these two things. And the classic study of this is the book by Edmund Morris that came out last year called Dutch, which, as far as I know, none of Reagan's friends ever called him. But Morris decided to make that the title, and everybody kind of got after him for having introduced himself as a fictional character in Ronald Reagan's life, and that became sort of the big story about that book. But the bigger story to me was the abysmal ignorance of the book about the policies of Ronald Reagan and the politics that brought Ronald Reagan to the presidency. And it was an amalgam of the liberal history and the World War XI type history. And he had the whole package there. And basically what Morris tells us, and you can read in Lou Cannon's books about Reagan or any of Bob Schieffer's, any book about Reagan, you can read that one morning in 1966, Ronald Reagan woke up and had been elected governor of California. And then 14 years later, he woke up one morning, he'd been elected president of the United States. And then he did a whole bunch of illegal things and bad, you know, cut the budget and threw people out in the snow and helped the Contras illegally and so forth and so on. And all that policy stuff is just totally wrong. But what I want to focus on is the political stuff, because to hear them tell it, Ronald Reagan, and to read Edmund Morris's treatment, Ronald Reagan just came from nowhere. And all of a sudden, here's this actor who's president of the United States, and he was the Teflon president, and he was a good communicator, And even though people didn't like his views, he got elected because of that. I mean, that's what these books say over and over again. And all of this is just totally erroneous. It has no connection to fact. And so what I would like to do in the three and a half hours that I have here is slowly to walk through all of this step by step. And so let me begin with, I go back to the period when that George mentioned, when by the time I got out of college, because if you go back before that, you really have to go to carbon dating. And we'll start there. And there was a period of about 10 years from 1950, mid-50s to mid-60s, when a lot of things were going on that Edmund Morris and Lou Cannon and lots of other folks weren't paying attention to and still don't know about. So maybe we can put this story together for them to read somewhere. First of all, if you look at what happened in that era, a number of things I think should be said. One is that the conservative movement was an embryo. It was just barely getting going. But there was one great advantage that we had then that we don't have today, and that was that the country generally was strong. The traditional values that undergirded America were still pretty much in place. And so you had a kind of matrix there of support, potential support out there, which was ready to be energized if we could reach it and articulate a case to it of what needed to be done from the standpoint of those traditional values. We also in that period were uniquely blessed, and looking back at it, we didn't really fully appreciate it at the time. In the first rank scholars who appeared in that period, had appeared earlier and continued to write in that period, and I don't want to start listing all the names, but Russell Kirk, Frank Meyer, Milton Friedman, Vogelin, very productive in that period, Mises, Hayek, Richard Weaver. We had all of that going for us at that time, and bit by bit we found our way to these writers and scholars and others like them. And so there was a very strong underpinning at that level for the entire enterprise, and we had publishers who brought out marvelous books. George and I have talked about this, the quote that I heard, the statement I heard Richard Weaver make here in Chicago. I'm sorry, it was in Indianapolis. You tracked it down. It was an ISI event in Indianapolis. And I remember asking him when I was a young neophyte there and he was speaking, I said, what is needed to redeem the times? What do we need? Professor Weaver said, without any hesitation, what we need are unshakable books, unshakable books. And he wrote unshakable books himself, and so did these other folks, and we had those unshakable books, and we have them to this day. So that was a tremendous advantage to us at that era to have such intellectual leadership as we did. We, in addition, began to develop, we meaning generically conservatives at large, circuits of communication. We'd had human events in the Freeman magazine dating back to the 40s and 50s. In 1955, added to this, Bill Buckley founded National Review. And then in 1957, Russell and Henry Regnery founded Modern Age. So we developed a method of communicating among ourselves with these publications and also of writing and publishing scholarly articles that could not otherwise find a venue. This was a period in which the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, then called the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists, was building its cadres on the campuses. And our dear good friend Don Lipset, Vic Milioni, and others were very active in that enterprise. In 1960, Young Americans for Freedom was founded, from which today's Young America's Foundation is descended. And these organizations were very active on the campuses in the early 1960s. And all of this began to percolate into the political community. In the college Republicans, the young Republicans, and thereafter in the senior party. And finally, I would add, at this very narrow period of time between 1960 and 1964, there was a lot of spontaneous conservative activity all over the country, and rallies and meetings and whatnot, speeches. And all of this converged in 1962, 1963, 1964 into the Goldwater Movement. All of these streams of activity came together in that movement, and that really is the way the process worked. It started with the ideas. It started with the philosophy. It started with the books. It started with the scholars, and then in sequence made its way into the political arena. And this intellectual activity that preceded the political activity, in my view, cannot be stressed too much. It was important intrinsically because we need good scholarship, but in these terms it was important because first it gave us conservatives, traditionalists, libertarians, and we debated those issues a lot, as some of you know, back then, a common ground. We began to see the commonalities as opposed to the superficial conflicts. We began to see how traditional values were needed to undergird a free society. And so that was important. But in addition, it gave us a core of principle that made the movement rock solid. It was rock solid. I mean, you could not shake these people. And that was of the utmost significance because we all knew, as soon as John Kennedy was killed in November of 1963, there wasn't anybody that thought Barry Goldwater was going to be elected president in 1964. He didn't think he was going to be elected president, and I don't know anybody else who thought it. But that did not stop the Goldwater movement. And that long march that really began here in the Cow Palace in 1960, and I won't go into that, I don't have time, that long march continued. And we knew that we were going to take a tough defeat in November 64, and we had everything against us, every medium of communication, all the magazines, all the television networks, everything, just pounding Goldwater day after day after day. We knew it was going to be tough. And it was. It was a tough morning after. And the thing, for some of you young people may not understand it, those days we had no grief counselors. And so it made it, I mean, I could tell you stories. We did not even have remotes for the TV. So if you, are you in a mall, I mean, these kids need to hear this stuff. You were in a mall, you went out of the Circuit City into the Gap, you were outdoors. Those malls were not, there was no cover. So we were tough people, is what I'm saying. And as a result of being so tough, we after the defeat, you know, the New York Times are exalted. That's it. They had their ideological, excursion, went down to defeat. That's the end of it. Goodbye, Barry Goldwater. Goodbye, conservative movement. We won't be hearing from you anymore. But they did. We picked ourselves up, all of us. We got up the next day, literally, as soon as, you know, we dug out from under the rubble, and started over. Or more accurately, kept going. And it's interesting that part of that activity to keep going was the founding of this group, which was really founded in a sequence of meetings in 1964, and they came into being after the election. And the first national meeting, okay, Ed Fulner was reminding me, was in this very hotel, 1965. So the Philadelphia Society was itself a product of this resolution, of this core principle: we would not be stopped, we would keep going. American Conservative Union was, again, founded in the immediate aftermath of the 1964 election. And, of course, the main thing that caught people's attention was that in 1965, Henry Salvatore and some other folks out in California said, we need to get Ronald Reagan to run for governor of California. And they did, he did, and got elected. And that's the way this thing unfolded. And I won't bore you with the more recent history, but basically Reagan went on the run in 76, and the run in 1976 was fueled by exactly the same kind of people that worked for the Goldwater candidacy in 1964. They were going against the establishment, state after state after state after state. They were driven by the ideas. They were driven by the principles. They weren't looking for jobs. They weren't pragmatically testing the wind. They knew that if they went against the governor, the sitting governor, and state after state after state, or the party chairman, there was no political future for them in doing that, but they did it. And that run in 76, in turn, set the table for the run in 1980 and Reagan's election as president. There are two lessons there from my standpoint. The first is, I've said already, the primacy of ideas, the primacy of principles, convictions. And the second is that the action was at the grassroots. The two most important elections, in my view, which were involved in this sequence, were the 1964 Republican presidential primary in California, when Goldwater and Rockefeller went head to head in California. And the 1976 North Carolina primary between Reagan and Gerald Ford. And if either of those primaries had gone the other way, if Goldwater had lost to Rocky in California, I think they could have denied him the nomination in 64. And if Reagan had lost to Ford in Carolina in 76, that would have been the end of Ronald Reagan as a presidential candidate. In fact, some of the people in his entourage were negotiating the surrender of his sword with Rogers Morton at the very time that primary is being won. The distinctive aspect of those two primaries is that they had nothing to do with anybody in Washington, D.C. There was nobody in Washington, D.C. That was doing any of that. It was all done by the grassroots people in the states, who had the principles, who had the beliefs, and who had the toughness to battle it out. Okay, so that's sort of my version of where it all came from. If we come forward to more recent times, you can see that some of what I'm talking about kind of got lost along the way in the 1980s, and some of that loss was inevitable because it was the consequence of the success of Ronald Reagan. When Ronald Reagan got elected president, lots of things changed. And the most obvious thing that changed was all these grassroots activists who had been out there in Texas or Indiana or wherever working for Reagan as insurgents came to Washington to help staff the administration, and they, as well they should have. However, that took them out of the grassroots and brought them to the government. Something else that happened, which again was incident to success and probably unavoidable, was that while a number of people, such as our good friend Ed Fulner and others, have struggled to maintain the primacy of ideas in the conservative political enterprise in Washington, inevitably what we saw coming to the fore was the primacy of politics. And that had a lot of consequences. For example, young people who two decades before would have come out of college and gone to work in the Goldwater campaign or gone on to become conservative activists or something, now wanted to come to Washington to get a job at HUD. And so it sure didn't exactly, it wasn't quite the same thing. And then we picked up the inevitable, again, inevitable consequence of success, the courtiers, the zeitgeist surfers, other folks, just job seekers generally, that any successful political movement will pick up. And this, again, it's the catch-22. A large movement, a large successful movement, is going to be necessarily less focused than an insurgent movement. And that's kind of what happened. And I'm not even saying it could have been avoided, but the consequence was a lack of gravitas, to put it, lack of ballast in some of our folks there who had not gone through the fiery furnace, who had not done the homework, and who kind of didn't know what it was all about and tended to get caught up in the game in Washington. And we've all seen a lot of that. And this becomes the more serious problem when one looks at the intractability of what is in Washington. The entitlement machine and the built-in, locked-in advantage of the spending interests and the bureaucracy and the programs that have been so embedded in authorizations that they run almost automatically, irrespective of the appropriations process. And we've all seen too much of that. I heard someone once describe this process, the way the government works in the real world, as opposed to the civics book, as a self-licking ice cream cone, it just keeps going, and one consequence of observing that is I have come to realize that our model, the model in which we were working all these years, I wouldn't say it was an inaccurate model, but it was an incomplete model. Our model was a model of electoral politics, driven in the fashion I've described. And we assumed that once we won the election, that we, or people like us, would actually control the government. Wrong. That's not the way it works. And so you've got to have something, just winning the election, you got to win the elections. I'm not disparaging that, but that is not nearly adequate. And I see a lot of folks, Dan Oliver and others, sitting around the room here that know what I'm talking about because you've worked in that environment and you know what the intractabilities are. Now, coming forward to today, I'm not going to, many things that one might say about all those other matters, casting up a balance sheet on this as to kind of where we are now as a result of successes and then maybe some backsliding, there are some negatives in the balance sheet, no doubt about it. One is that the strength of the country, the general strength, that moral capital that based on traditional values has been seriously depleted, to put it charitably. Second, the colleges and universities, as the ISI, Young America's Foundation, other folks know all too well, are much, much worse than they were in the past. And third, the mainstream media are much worse also. And all of these things converge, and I have just an anecdote that something I saw on TV a couple of years ago, it just kind of summed it up for me. It was on CNBC, and this is supposed to be a financial network, right? And the explosion of cable is going to give us more options, and it has. But also, in my calculation, it's sort of given us more things that are not worth watching. And so I'm surfing the channel, and CNBC has an interview show with a very nice looking anchor type couple, man and woman. They're interviewing two cross dressers. And it was a very serious interview, and these two guys are sitting there, and they do not look like women. They look, have you ever seen these Bud Light commercials where the guy are dressed up like women and they're trying to get the free drinks on ladies' night? They kind of look like that. And they were wigs, and they had a purse and pearls and lipstick and so forth. And one thing I found out, that cross-dressing is not the same as transvestism. I didn't know that. Did you know that? Totally different thing. And so anyway, that was the first thing. But then they talked about the benefits of this cross-dressing and why they did it, and it made it feel good and so on. So it really sounded very, very positive. And at one point in this interview, one interviewer says to him, "Well, I mean, you make it sound so good. Is there like any downside?" And so this one guy says, "Yeah," he says, "sometimes if you're in a bar, weirdos will come on to you." I would love. Who does this guy think is a weirdo? So okay. Then there. Anyway, you got that. I mean, that's what's. Why is this on my television set? But then we go to what I call the politics of vapidity, and this is the world of shouting heads on TV. They don't just have talking heads anymore. There are people shouting at each other. Very, very informative. And we also have perception management. There is actually a firm in Washington that has sent a card to me. It's in the, I won't name it. And it says on it, perception management. That's what they do. We have focus groups. The Republican Party in Congress can't do anything unless it calls together a focus group and finds out what the focus group thinks about it or reads the polls. Now, looking at all of that, perception management, focus groups, there would never have been a Goldwater movement ever if that's the way people had operated back then. And the politics of vapidity is so pervasive that one could go on and on about it for a long time. Let me just, this is another true story I will cite. People question the fact that the election calendar gets being pushed back earlier and earlier and earlier. And, so about the Iowa caucuses, the New Hampshire primary, and there were straw polls back in 99, and it's getting very, very early. However, at the National Journalism Center, we date the election cycle in a different way, and we date it earlier than that. We date it at the sighting of the first lumberjack shirt. And it turned out that the first lumberjack shirt in this election cycle was spotted. And it was photographed. It was on the front page, not on the front page, on the pages of both the Washington Post and the Washington Times. And it was actually prior to the 1998 by-elections. That's how early we spotted this shirt. To no one's surprise, it was on Al Gore. He was wearing it. And the story was that Gore and Governor Glendening of Maryland were going to meet with a group of farmers to tell the farmers why, for some reason that I can't remember, they couldn't do something with their land. That's what they always are telling the farmers these days. And so they were going to meet with this group of farmers in Maryland, and the pictures show Gore and Glendening looking very, very manly, alpha male type guys, striding forth in their lumberjack shirts to meet these farmers. And then the other picture, the other paper showed them with the farmers. Now, it so happened that none of the farmers was wearing a lumberjack shirt. All of the farmers were wearing coats and ties. And people say, this is an anomaly. Well, it really isn't. None of the farmers are running for public office. So, so anyway, that's, I mean, there are many, many such anecdotes that it, we're kind of, it's worse than that, though, because when you get this sort of vapid politics, you end up rudderless, to put it mildly, at the national policy level. And worse. And you can look at any, I mean, the Elion thing is just, you know, a case study in everything possible that could be wrong in Washington, D.C. But it isn't just that. The Clinton has been giving the store away to Red China, transferring technology to Red China to improve their missiles and many, many other things of that nature. And in that regard, I might say that the president actually joked about this in a side, which was picked up by, I think, Jerry Sieper of the Washington Times, and he said that to one of his aides, he said, you know, the problem with appeasing Red China is that a couple of hours later, you want to do it again. And so he didn't. He did not really say that. I made that up. So, I mean, Bill Clinton is arguably the most despicable president we've ever had in the history of the United States. He proves it every day, and everybody knows he's a liar, and, you know, there's really no contest on that. And yet, he's beating our brains out. The Republican Party, it's just like he's just beating the Republican Party to death. And so, it's kind of bad news for the Republican Party. However, I do have some good news for the Republican Party. I know there's some Republicans in this room. And this good news is that the National Right to Life Committee voted just last week to endorse every Republican congressional candidate in the forthcoming November election, every last one of them, which is unprecedented. And the reason for this is in recognition of the many months that the Republican leadership in Congress has spent in the fetal position. That joke was tested with a focus group, so I don't think we should be getting that kind of feedback here. All right, that's Jim Hynes is going to get on my case saying I'm too negative. He's already done this once, so I'm going to talk about some positive stuff here, Jim. There are many things, and I mentioned Ed Fulner. You were out of the city, but you had a very fine column in the Washington Post answering these various folks saying the conservative movement is dead and all of that, and I thought you said it very well. It's not dead. No way is it dead. There are many, many, many positive factors here. One is an observation that is now commonplace, that everyone acknowledges that markets are superior to government intervention, at least in theory. Now, getting that in practice is another matter. So that's a huge, huge conceptual victory for the position we have taken for so many years. If you look at the infrastructure, the policy infrastructure, the intellectual transmission belts by which the intellectual stuff reaches the political arena. Look at the Heritage Foundation, Cato, look at the state think tanks. These are tremendous assets. We have many, many good new circuits of communication for our point of view. The ISI and Young Americans Foundation are both newly vigorous, working the campuses very hard. Things like the homeschooling movement, many, many other conservative groups and books and great financial resources. There's a lot there. There's a lot there to work with. And the question is, can we take what's there and build further on what already has been accomplished intellectually and politically? And I'm going to defer any political proposals in this forum, but just thinking about who we are, where we are, one principle I've always believed in is it's, you know, you can sit back and carp and complain about or suggest what other people should do, but we can't really control what other people do, but we can control what we do. So that's where we really need to take inventory and decide what our agenda should be and what our priorities are. And there's so much which is in the domain of the Philadelphia Society. And I think of all the fine scholars, the Forrest MacDonalds and Stephen Tonchers and so many others, I shouldn't start naming them, who have long been members of this society, and then looking at these new younger scholars coming online, that is a tremendous enterprise and tremendously encouraging. And we need that scholarship to recover our history, not just the history of the conservative movement, but the history of our country and the history of our civilization, which has again been warped and misstated repeatedly by the liberal historians. We need to continue working with these youth groups, the ISI and Young America's Foundation groups on the campuses. We've got to have them out there. And again, they interact so strongly with the Philadelphia Society. And the colleges, again, start listing names. It's trouble, but Hillsdale and Grove City and Aquinas and many, many others that we all know of that are keeping the faith and are working to give truly sound education to young people, which is not the case on so many other campuses. But beyond this, I think we need an offense. I think we need, and there's still sporadic fighting on some of these fronts over political correctness and things of that nature. We need to go on the offense against what is happening in the so-called mainstream colleges and universities. The outrages that occur there are not just the speech codes and not just the burning of papers and all that, as bad as that is. It's what is taught day in and day out in those classrooms. And I know myself as an alumnus of Yale University, the last thing that, when I get my Yale Alumni magazine, and Lou, I'm sure you read yours just as I do mine, I'm looking to see our classmates and so on. What they will not tell you, they'll talk about the Harvard game and the good days when you were at Yale and we're going to take a trip to the Mediterranean and all that stuff. What they won't tell you is what they're teaching in the classrooms of New Haven. And that is true of every alumni operation, every major college and university in the United States. That needs to be overcome, and we need some kind of effort to communicate to taxpayers, in the case of state universities, alumni, in the case of all universities, parents, legislators, in the case of the state schools, what is actually happening in the classrooms of these universities. And finally, coming back around to my ballpark, the media. We need much more effort to reclaim the media. They are as bad as the universities in their way. Now, that's assets, liabilities, and a modest sort of academic scholarly agenda. And again, I want to end on a more positive note. Please don't get me wrong, that I am immensely gratified by many, many developments of the past four decades. I've lived quite a while now, and there were two things I never thought I would live to see. One was Elton John singing in Westminster Abbey, and I remember John Wilson and I were in 1975, and I heard him singing Yellow Brick Road. And I said to John, I said, that guy is a terrific singer. Too bad he will never sing in Westminster Abbey. And yet, but that happened. That happened. And there was another thing. What was the other? I know. The fall of communism. That was the other thing. Which arguably was even more important than Elton John singing in Westminster Abbey. So anything, if those things can happen, anything can happen. So just to put it this way, in the past 40 years, many good, allegedly impossible things have indeed been accomplished. If we remember and go back to and stick to the basics, as members of this society have always done, the next 40 years can be better yet. My time is up. I thank you for yours.